I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 9th of June. Mondays at 1 is All Things Political, some of the stories we will be covering for All Things Political today. On Friday, Wisconsin's same-sex marriage ban was ruled unconstitutional. The men freed from Guantanamo Bay in exchange for the release of Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, has the president paid too high a price for the release of the sergeant? A shooting last Thursday at Seattle Pacific University, one student was killed. A shooting in Las Vegas yesterday, two police officers were having lunch at a pizza buffet when a man and woman walked in and fatally shot them, fled to a nearby Walmart, killing a third person and then themselves. Our guest this hour has written about Senator Richard Blumenthal from Connecticut, who plans to press Democratic leaders to again try to pass gun control legislation with a greater focus on mental health resources. Have you seen the stories about the number of children who are coming by themselves into the U.S. from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador? The president has declared an urgent humanitarian situation along the southwest border. Kenneth Wolf with the Office of Refugee Resettlement has said his agency expects to take in nearly 60,000 children. Many have traveled all by themselves. Senators Bernie Sanders and John McCain have reached a deal on bipartisan legislation aimed at reforming the veterans' health care system. And as you heard from NPR just a few minutes ago, the president today takes executive action to ease college debt. Our guest this hour is Jennifer Bendry, White House and congressional reporter for the Huffington Post, previously covered Congress for 4 years for Roll Call and spent 4 years covering the Texas legislature for Gallery Watch in Austin. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Jennifer. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter at K Dunn Show. Hi, Jennifer. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being with us. Let's start in Wisconsin. Last Friday, and it was right before Pride Fest celebrations and the Summerfest grounds this weekend, Wisconsin's same-sex marriage ban ruled unconstitutional. One state after another seems to be doing this. We're number 12. When does the Supreme Court take this up and just make this whole issue of a ban on same-sex marriage unconstitutional?
Well, as everybody knows, they did take it up. Has it been a year now?
It has almost.
It's been about a year, and they struck down a core piece of the Defense of Marriage Act. So that was a huge win for proponents of gay rights and same-sex marriage. There's a lot of people who don't really know when the Supreme Court is going to bring this up. That they brought up some cases this morning and announced what they were going to do and not do for a period of time, but there's nothing related to gay marriage. At this point, the way it's playing out in states is just, I feel as if we're still in that stage. We're still seeing the repercussions of the last thing that the Supreme Court did and just seeing this domino effect across the country.
Yes.
In states that you wouldn't even expect it. I mean, we're talking about Utah and Michigan and Arkansas. I mean, states just popping up where there are judges striking down their bans on same-sex marriage. And then just a week or two later, you've got another state doing it too. So at this point, I think more eyes are watching to see how the first Supreme Court ruling is now being trickling across the country and playing out.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's interesting, in the state of Wisconsin, which is very much a red state these days, the attorney general has asked for a stay in the ruling. But even with that request, many conservative counties, and there are many of them in Wisconsin, are not waiting for the decision on the stay. They're going ahead and issuing marriage licenses today.
That's amazing. I read somewhere that between last Friday night and then Saturday afternoon, there was something like 283 same-sex couples got married in Wisconsin.
Yes.
That was in less than 24 hours. And that was primarily in two cities, I think, maybe Milwaukee and Madison.
Mm-hmm.
But that just shows you this incredible eagerness and excitement that gay couples have to just be recognized just as equal couples. I mean, it's not asking for the world here. It's asking for benefits and being treated the same. So I think one of the things people overlook with same-sex marriages cropping up is how good it is for the economies, too. I was reading about this, how someone did a study at UCLA on Colorado and their wedding business, and they figured out that the states, that it would increase revenue by $50 million over 3 years.
Oh, my.
By making same-sex marriage legal, and that would be $32 million in the first year. I mean, think of all the family members that come to weddings, all the places that get rented out, hotels, restaurants, all the fanfare. It's like it's an economic win for states, too.
Absolutely. So, think of the cake, right? That's what I think
the cakes,
about.
The dresses.
The cake, yeah, right.
The fantastic parties. I mean, imagine how fabulous some of these parties will be.
Absolutely. We're interested in the audience response to this, too. What do you think of the ruling in Wisconsin on Friday? Our number, we're going to move to other topics, as we always do with this segment, but feel free to comment on any of them as we move along. 800-486-8655. Let's talk about a story that I think is going to be with us for a long period of time. The men freed from Guantanamo Bay in exchange for the release of Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. There are a lot of second guessing the president. Should he have spoken to people in Congress about this? Did this guy desert? Did he not desert? Are these guys from Guantanamo Bay going to come back and get us at some point? And it also begs the question of what are we going to do about the people who are still at Guantanamo Bay. What do you think of all of this? Do you know who this sergeant is? Do you have a better sense of who he is and what he's done? And should we have exchanged five, some have called bad guys, from Guantanamo Bay for his release?
Well, I think what's a really interesting dynamic in this case is the way that people's responses in Washington have changed once they figured out that Obama is the one doing this. You saw a whole bunch of Republican members of Congress saying for years, I mean, keep in mind, this guy has been gone for 4 or 5 years. It's not like he was gone for 6 months and now mm-hmm. we just got him back. Mm-hmm. He's been held captive for years. So you've had plenty of time over the years. You've got lots of Republican members of Congress saying, this is a prisoner of war. He's our last prisoner of war who's an American from the Iraq or Afghanistan wars. We've got to get him back. We don't leave anyone behind. This is a standard message when we have prisoners of war. So then fast forward to a couple weeks ago when this deal emerged and we got in the swap, the prisoner swap happened. Suddenly you start seeing on Fox News and you start seeing on conservative websites like Breitbart a recasting of what this is. No longer is it about bringing back every last American prisoner of war. It's about a bad trade. It's about this guy being a potential deserter. It's about the president not following a rule where he should have told Congress 30 days in advance that this was coming. And suddenly the fact that we just brought back an American prisoner of war safely, and he's being held still to revive his health because he's in bad health, suddenly there's no more focus on the fact that we just got back our last prisoner of war. Mm-hmm. So I think that... there's still a lot of details emerging, you know, that some people were very uncomfortable with the fact that we just traded one person for five prisoners at Guantanamo, some of whom were leading Taliban, terrorists, or at least aligned with terrorists. So there's still details coming out on, you know, what's going to happen now with these five people. Are we protected from them now that we've let them go? But at the same time, they've been held in Guantanamo, which is already arguably an illegal prison that still hasn't closed, and we just got back our last prisoner of war. So I think the messaging around this guy has been pretty unfair to the president, and I do think, as someone who works inside the Beltway, that a lot of the anger being vented here in D.C. is because a lot of the Republicans here really just don't want to support the president. I truly believe that.
Mm, interesting. And what about Guantanamo? It's been there for so long now. So many people have been there for, 13 years. Once we completely withdraw from Afghanistan, what happens in Guantanamo? Will that ever be closed? Will people ever be sent somewhere else?
Well, if you remember, that was one of President Obama's campaign promises,
yes,
was to close Guantanamo. And here we are, 5.5 years in, and it's still open. We've still got a lot of people there. And there's not a whole lot of talk about it. I mean, the recent talk about the five Taliban people we just swapped for Bo Bergdahl. That's the first time you've even really seen Guantanamo back in the center stage. Mm-hmm. And the problem really comes back to Congress not giving the president the authorization to go ahead and close it and directions on where to put people. I mean, you've seen bills come up in Congress where they could do something. And, of course, they always have the opportunity to do something as legislators. But there's so much division on this. They just can't bring themselves to close Guantanamo because then the question is, well, what do you do with these people? Some people think they should be transferred to federal prisons or military-type prisons around the country. Some should say they should go before federal courts, just like the rest of us. But in the end, that Congress does not have the votes in its current makeup to put forward something to close the prison. So mm-hmm. it's just going to stay open until lawmakers do something.
Mm-hmm.
The president can't do it by himself.
Let's talk about the latest round of shootings. We had, of course, the shooting in Seattle last week, Thursday, I believe, and then yesterday, another shooting in Las Vegas. Two police officers who were eating pizza on their lunch break were killed, somebody outside Walmart, by two people who subsequently killed themselves, a student killed at Seattle Pacific. These seem to be happening in one or two a week now. They're posted on page 10 of the paper instead of all over page 1. You had a posting on May 25th. Senator Richard Blumenthal from Connecticut plans to press Senate Democratic leaders to take another crack at passing gun control legislation that failed last year with a greater focus on mental health resources. Can you explain that more fully, and does that stand any chance of getting anywhere?
One thing you hear around the halls of Congress among Democrats is we're not giving up. We're not giving up on reforms to gun policies. And it's always sort of a low simmering conversation because after last year, they tried a big push in the Senate to pass a package of reforms built around expanded background checks on gun sales. Well, that went down really narrowly, but it went down. Ever since then, there's this feeling that it's just not going to happen. In the meantime, we've seen, like you said, in the last week, we just saw two more mass shootings. And it does start to feel very commonplace. And then there's this sense, again, this is horrible. Why is this happening? What can we do? And then we look to Congress to do something, and they don't do anything. So Senator Blumenthal, who's from Connecticut, where, you know, they were in the Newtown shooting,
mm-hmm.
Has been very passionate about this, and he made a plea in the last week or so that once again, he said, I'm going to try to talk to my Democratic leaders about giving another push to some kind of gun-related bill, but maybe we can focus on mental health resources, providing more resources for mental health services nationwide. But I think the problem here is that you just don't have Republicans willing to do anything related to guns. And if you start with that premise, you can't really get much done on other issues if they're connected to guns. So I think the only way something would get done that addresses, you know, mental health needs, provides more resources for outreach to people who are unstable or who need help, these kinds of things. If it's attached to any kind of gun reform or any kind of gun language, I have a hard time believing that Republicans in this current Congress would vote for it. Mm. They just can't bring themselves to go against the NRA and the gun lobby. Mm-hmm. It is perceived or not, the NRA is very powerful, and just the mention of the NRA makes people back off. And I don't really know why. I don't know if they have that much money or they just have the perception of being that scary. And maybe they're really not, kind of like Oz behind the curtain. But in the end, things that are related to guns just don't go anywhere in this Congress.
You had a piece, Jay Carney, remembering the big moments of his time as press secretary for the president, and you write about the weight of the office really striking him on the day of that mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary. You write, there was something so devastating about Newtown that it shook the president. I've never seen him so upset, you write, and he said. Jennifer?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
And yes, you're right, yes. That interview that Jay Carney gave stood out to me because, I mean, you see, the president has to deal with so many different issues all the time, foreign policy, domestic policy. One minute he's doing a photo op with, you know, World War II veterans. an hour later, he's giving a speech on student loans. You know, 2 hours later, he's meeting with, you know, leaders from the Ukraine or something. But it was the Newtown shootings that his White House press secretary, after 3 years of working with him, said, this is the one thing that really, really got to him. Because when you've got a situation where elementary school children are being gunned down, and it just, you know, in a small town in Connecticut, and this is, you know, this was 2012 in the United States, it's just, imagine being the president, having to hear that and then react to that and then give a message to the country. And it becomes a lot bigger than that. It's not just that school that day. It's like, it's a question of like, how did this even happen? Like,
right.
Is this really who we are as
exactly.
a country? And here I am as the president. What can I do? I understand, you know, Jay Carney was saying how helpless it could feel even as the president of the United States when something like that happens, because what can you say?
Right.
He has two daughters.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's a parent. So that was a really notable moment, I think, when Carney pointed that out, because it's just, you see a moment when even the president of the United States is at a loss.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We have yet to talk about Bernie Sanders and John McCain reaching a deal on reforming the veterans' health care system. We'll talk about that. What astounds me about that story is, I mean, there are so many people who should have known what's going on. People blame the president, but what about senators, be they Democratic or Republican, and people who run these facilities? It's a huge story, and everybody's blaming everybody else when there should be a collective sense of responsibility for this. President Obama vented his anger as the report surfaced of misconduct at 26 VA facilities, people allegedly dying while they were waiting for appointments, and then record keeping changed to benefit those who are working in the facilities. It's a horrendous story. We don't seem to do well by our veterans ever. This isn't a case of egregious wrongdoing, and nobody seems to want to step up and say, I'm sorry, we should have done better, I should have done better. So we'll talk about what was the bipartisan deal they worked on. And we'll welcome phone calls. We have many of them coming in. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. We've already talked a little bit about Wisconsin's same-sex marriage ban ruled unconstitutional on Friday. What do you think that means? Is it just a matter of more states ruling the same? Because every state is ruling the same, and many of the decisions are being appealed before the Supreme Court will step in and say that a ban on this is unconstitutional, which seems inevitable. The question is when that's going to happen. It is, when you stop and think of it, a fairly remarkable thing. We're talking about more shootings and an attempt by a Democratic senator from Connecticut, where Newtown happened, to try to pass some kind of gun legislation. And we are talking about Sergeant Bo Bergdahl and the Guantanamo Bay exchange. And we have yet to talk about young children. We're going to do a full hour on this down the road. These young children who are coming by themselves from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, tens of thousands, making this precarious journey by themselves to get into the United States. And we have other things too. So we'll be with you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And here's how you reach us now, 800-486-8655. Jennifer Bendry, White House and congressional reporter for the Huffington Post, is our guest this hour. And we start our calls with Reed in Clintonville. Hi, Reed.
Yes, good afternoon. They have two issues. I'll be real short with them, but just prior to that, I just wanted to mention that Target does allow open carry in all of their stores, and it's happened in Wisconsin Target stores, and I think they need to be boycotted. But the first issue that I was concerned about was the maligning of the parents, and especially the father of the young soldier that is being brought home, maligning him because he has a beard, and criticizing him for looking like the Taliban while they celebrate the clowns on Duck Dynasty, all of which have beards. And it's just such a bizarre idea that one person can look like the Taliban, but the others are true patriots. That's the first issue. The second issue is I'm just concerned about the fact that the Republicans and T-Publicans in the Congress and the Senate continually vote against funding the VA. One example is Representative Jason Chaffetz, who's a Republican from Utah, and talks about things not looking right in Benghazi, et cetera, et cetera. But then when the question's put to him, is it true that you voted to cut the funding for the embassy security, he says, in his words, absolutely, when you're in tough economic times, you have to prioritize things. Well, you know, you can't blame the president and the Democrats and any others out there that have a heart and a brain for something that you are doing and expect people to actually believe that you're sincere.
Thank you very much for your call, Reed. Jennifer.
Well, I guess there's a few things there. I would like to note to that caller that I just saw that Senators Murphy and Blumenthal, who are the two Connecticut U.S. senators, they just issued a statement together specifically calling on Target, the Target CEO.
Oh, really?
To prevent people from carrying firearms into Target. It's kind of absurd that we're at this point that people have to ask giant corporations to please not let people carry loaded guns into their stores. Mm-hmm. But this is where we are, and they have sent a letter to the Target CEO. So that issue is certainly on the radar of members of Congress. And then the other thing, it is sort of interesting how people have given some flack to Bo Bergdahl's father for the way he looks. You know, he grew a beard. He said something
Pashtun. Pashtun. He learned Pashtun.
Yes, he learned Pashtun and tried to become more connected to the situation his son was in. But, you know, to the credit of humanity, I did read a story about how his town in Haley, Idaho, you know, his neighbors have said that the family is just a great family and they're very nice and they have a lot of support in their town. It's just that I think people who are more removed from the situation and just kind of glossing over generalities of it, or maybe it reveals people's own prejudices about the way people look. You know, people have, phobias of people who are different from them. But mm-hmm. It is heartening to hear that for all the controversy around Bo Bergdahl and his family and everything around it, it sounds like his family has support back home, and mm-hmm. that matters a lot to them.
What was the legislation that Senators Bernie Sanders and John McCain agreed on, Jennifer?
So that was on a different issue. That was on Veterans Affairs.
Right.
It is rare around here these days for anything bipartisan to happen. It truly is. So the fact that people as different as Senator Bernie Sanders, who is self-identified as a socialist from Vermont, and John McCain, who is a Republican from Arizona, they agreed on a bill together. That's in itself, never mind what the bill is, that in itself is progress on something. But they did agree to a bill that would reform some parts of the VA system. And, of course, this is in response to all the problems that were unearthed in the last few weeks. But namely, their bill, it would allow for the construction of 26 more medical facilities around the country. They would provide $500 million to hire more doctors and nurses. They would allow veterans to go to their private doctors if they're having too long of a wait time to get into a VA facility. Because at the heart of this, this controversy around the VA system being so troubled, is the wait times that many of these veterans have had to endure. Mm-hmm. Just today, during the White House briefing, people were talking about how the latest report shows that 57,000 veterans have waited more than 90 days for an appointment around the country.
Oh, my.
And these are veterans. I mean, these are people that we should be providing the best of care for. They put their lives on the line for this country. They come back, and there's a system set up to take care of them that not only is it problematic, that there's a lot of problems with it, but people seem to know this. So it's that connection between this is a huge system with a lot of problems. We know that, but then why aren't we doing anything about it? That's sort of the sense around here that it feels like. Why isn't Congress doing anything? Why has it taken this to fix a system that we've already known is riddled with problems. So I guess the upside is, well, now they are doing something about it. So we'll see if this bill goes somewhere. I mean, it has bipartisan authors. That is a big plus in this current Congress.
Well, let me ask you to answer that question for us. I don't understand that as well. It seems as though it's not just Republican, Democratic here. Remember the controversy, the horrendous conditions at Walter Reed Hospital. That was the last scandal here. You've got all kinds of doctors and nurses and veterans and members of Congress and local state legislators and senators. I mean, everybody should have some knowledge of the VA system, and as you say, they must have known about the problems because those are their constituents. How in the world could you find out that problems were this mammoth, and be you a Democrat or a Republican or whatever, you don't do anything about it? I don't understand that. What happened? Well, what happened to everybody?
I think what happened is that nobody seems to know what to do. I think that people are just so... it's sort of almost an accepted thing now. This system is so big and so riddled with problems, but we don't know what to do about it. Let's just keep talking about how it's really big and has problems.
Right, right.
And granted, I don't know the ins and outs of this system. I'm sure they're very complicated. I have no solution to this. But I mean, the House Veterans Affairs Committee and the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, both committees formed solely to talk about veterans affairs. Those two committees combined have had more than 90 hearings in the last year and a half VA system.
Right.
90 hearings. Mm. And each individual hearing involves a panel of witnesses, a lot of prep work, a lot of paperwork, and a lot of discussion. So personally, what I don't understand is why that hasn't – I don't understand why that hasn't already translated into something. What was all that talking? What were all those documents and the reports? I just don't understand – personally. Now, Senator Bernie Sanders, who is the chairman of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee and also the co-author of this bipartisan bill, his point is that the system is just inundated with 2 million new veterans from Afghanistan and Iraq wars. We are just not equipped to handle the load, so we have to put more people into the system to help, and we need more money for that. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you say we need more money, people balk,
right?
Especially Republicans. So it's not necessarily a partisan problem here. It's just that it's going to require some money, and Republicans in particular are very reluctant to support things that involve new spending, especially in an election year.
Let's go to
unfortunately.
Wayne and Holman next. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Wayne.
Hey, go Giovanni. What a game.
I know. Aren't they great? Yeah.
Oh, man. I'm really pumped.
I'm with you.
You know, I appreciate the guest. I guess I, as a conservative Republican, I don't agree with her liberal points of view, but that's okay. That will make this country great. My question, two questions real quick. Some of the parents who had lost their sons who were on patrol trying to find Mr. Bergenthal, we're wondering if they were going to be invited to the White House and meet with the president, since they were truly heroes, as I understand it. And secondly, the five fellows that were released, you had stated that the president does not have the authority or power to do that, that Congress does that. I thought these five fellows were released from Guantanamo. And Dianne Feinstein said they were not informed, and she's a leading Democrat and was very upset with President Obama for not informing Congress.
Yeah, she was.
So would you please address those points, particularly the five guys that were released from Guantanamo by Obama, and you say he has no authority to do so. Thank you.
Thank you, Wayne.
Sure. So just to be clear, what I was saying before is that the president does not have the authority to close Guantanamo by himself. Congress actually has to do that. What the president can do and does have the authority to do is to work on things like prisoner swaps. And this is a long tradition with our country in negotiations with other countries for swapping prisoners. And in the case of and this caller is correct, there are Democrats that were really mad that they didn't get their 30-day notification. That is something that is spelled out in the I think it's the defense authorization bill every year. They wanted notice. They felt like the president acted unilaterally. This, you know, there's already tensions about the president, you know, not telling Congress enough, which applies to multiple, you know, it's not just Obama. This often happens between presidents and Congress. It's a division of power. People don't like when people don't get their part of this, you know, their say in something. But to be clear, I think that it's important to note that there are briefings going on currently between the White House and members of Congress explaining the White House's rationale in moving so quickly in the case of Bergdahl. And what they appear to be telling them is Bergdahl was at risk for being killed if they waited much longer to try to hash out a deal. They didn't feel they had the 30 days to wait because they could just kill him before then. His health was deteriorating, and time was very, very short in order to make this swap happen. These five Guantanamo people that were traded for him had been in talks. That was a known thing for years among people on Capitol Hill and in the White House. Those five people were not suddenly chosen. This was something that people knew about as a potential swap. So in the end, I think the White House made a call to do this because they felt like they would lose Bergdahl completely if they didn't move fast. And there is a provision that the president argues allows him to do this and not give Congress the 30 days notice and put it into a signing statement on a bill.
What about his point that there were, and I haven't seen any completely factual reporting on this, that there were soldiers, were there or were there not, who were killed in attempts to go out and try and find Bergdahl?
Yeah, so it sounds like they're the people in his crew, I'm not sure what it's called, his platoon or his troop or his group, there were people sent out to look for him. It sounds as if they had to, the team had to kind of halt operations, whatever they were doing, if there were reports that Bergdahl might be able to be obtained. They would have to stop what they were doing and go out and check it out. And some people were killed doing some of these things. It sounds like, though, some people would say to that, well, it was already a dangerous job. These are people doing dangerous things in a time of war. Obviously, fatalities happen, and they're horrible. But it's not as if, some people are blaming Bergdahl and saying, you know, people died because of him. He deserted us.
Right.
Why should we be rescuing him?
Right.
But then the White House's argument is because he's an American prisoner of war and we don't leave anybody behind. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of, I can see it. I understand people's anger over it, but the White House is sticking to its core premise that we don't leave people behind. Even if he was a deserter, we will address that once he comes back here.
Our number is 800-486-8655. Jennifer Bendry is our guest for All Things Political this Monday. She is White House and congressional reporter for the Huffington Post. Let's go to Arnold in Cobb, Wisconsin. Hi, Arnold.
Good afternoon. A couple things I'd like to address. The gay marriage thing. I think the general public in the state, you know, they don't march up and down the street and so on. They did march to the ballot box some years ago and voted over 60% that they did not want this, that they wanted a marriage to be between a man and a woman. I just happened to have a gentleman at my house working, doing some repairs, and I mentioned about this, the VA subject you were talking. He said, I buy my own insurance so I don't have to go there. Maybe someday I will have to. Interesting comment.
Jennifer, would you like to respond?
Sure. So I think, and the second point that this caller was making, it's funny that he brings that up. I'm not sure if this person he was talking to was a veteran, but I have some friends who are veterans, and I have also asked them what they make of the mess with the VA system. And I do have friends who also they have their own insurance because they don't want to have to deal with the VA system. They have a spouse who they can get health insurance through, or they have a job now where they get it through their job, which is sad. I mean, it shows that even people who could go get it don't want to deal with the system because they know how riddled with problems it is. So, you know, hopefully that will help. Hopefully this latest, the discovery of all these problems will help to get things back in shape, and people maybe want to go back to the system because it does sound like once people do get the care they need within the VA system, it's actually pretty good care. It's just that they're waiting so long to get in. And why would you want to wait 90 days for a checkup? I mean, that's crazy.
Right. It's a long, long time.
And yeah. So
I don't know if you said this or not, but in parts of the bipartisan legislation, wasn't there something worked out so that if you live more than 40 miles away from a center, you can go to a private physician? There are instances where you can use your private physician if it's more accessible to you than go to the VA?
So that's been yes, there is a provision in this bill that if you experience a long wait time at your VA facility, and again, 90 days is what we're hearing for some, or you live more than 40 miles away from a VA facility, mm-hmm. this bill would allow you to go see a private doctor, which is a really new approach for the VA system. There's a lot of Republicans in Washington right now pushing to try to privatize some of these services to have less reliance on the VA system entirely and, you know, maybe have contracts out to private providers. That's a huge shift for the VA system. There's a lot of pushback on doing that, but this bill actually does start to open the possibility for that to start happening.
We welcome more phone calls momentarily for All Things Political for this Monday, the 9th of June. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. We sometimes get to Facebook messages, but it's always great after the show to read some of the messages. You may want to comment on what other Facebook people have said on their post or what was said on the air as well. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Before we go back to phone calls, we're going to do a full show on this, but I was watching the news last night and was just astounded. I think this is an underreported story, Jennifer. Kenneth Wolf with the Office of Refugee Resettlement telling ABC News, actually, that his agency expects to take in nearly 60,000 children who have gone by themselves from mostly El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras to the southwest border by themselves to be reunited, some of them with family members who were here and had enough money to send back for their children. This is one heck of a treacherous journey. And now they're in bad conditions once they come into the United States. Can you believe that many children were trying to get here on their own?
That is pretty outrageous. I mean, what does that tell you about where they're coming from?
Wow.
And
I know.
You know that. And there have been a series of photos that maybe you and some of your callers have seen that surfaced in the last several days of the conditions at some of the processing centers in Texas, and where thousands of children and families are just packed into these tiny facilities
right.
that are not equipped to handle this magnitude of people who are just crossing the border. I mean, it's completely overwhelmed the system to the point where today the White House was, you know, they're referring to this as a humanitarian crisis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just when we've talked to people who have made that journey. I can't remember the guy's name who wrote the books about last year or 2 years ago. And what a treacherous, difficult journey that is. To be a little kid doing it on your own just breaks your heart, doesn't it? Just breaks your heart. All right, let's go to Kevin in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Kevin.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to bring up something about the gun issue again.
All right.
Can you hear me?
Oh, we can loud and clear, Kevin. Go
okay,
ahead.
Okay, great, because I don't know, there's been some problems. But I'm increasingly disturbed by the mentality of the gun culture in this country. I was riding with a fellow the other day in my job, and he's of the mentality, and I've encountered this before, but it's just really uncomfortable to be with such a person. But he thinks that the citizen should have as many guns as it would take to fend off the military. And I'm wondering how the Second Amendment, shouldn't the Second Amendment be like a matter of degree? I mean, can't we have the right to bear arms without having the right to bear huge arsenals of high-powered weapons? And I understood the mother at Sandy Hook had a huge arsenal of high-powered weapons, and she showed her kid how to use these weapons. And, you know, I had an argument with a fellow, actually my brother, who thought that teachers should have guns in schools because then, according to him, then these problems wouldn't happen. And when I pointed out, well, if a tenth of those guns were stolen, then we'd have more problems. And his answer, of course, was, shut up. And so apparently my First Amendment, anyway, I'm getting off track, but I think it'll take a generation or realize that just the amount of guns around, and I'm just not very optimistic about this. It's just so many people think that. And another thing I wanted to get to is that every
brief,
time
Kevin,
we have one of these incidents, the people that defend the right to bear arms will say, well, such and such a law would not prevent that crime. So it's like this law would be no good because it wouldn't prevent that crime.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Kevin, very much for your call. He says that he doesn't believe anything is going to happen for a while. If an event like Newtown happens and you don't have any kind of gun laws, you wonder when you'll ever get them, don't you, Jennifer?
It was pretty crushing after Newtown that Congress didn't do anything. I mean, if Congress isn't going to do something after more than 20 children and a handful of teachers at an elementary school just get gunned down in a sleepy town in Connecticut, if Congress can't do something in response to that,
yeah,
it is pretty crushing that here we are now in the last week. We just had another mass shooting in Vegas and in Seattle. I think that, like the caller was suggesting, it's going to take like a culture shift in order for something to change. It's not going to be another shooting, unfortunately. It's going to take a whole bunch of shootings. I mean, what does it take to get the people who control the policy in this country to make a policy change? I mean, they have the ability to do something, and maybe, I don't know if you've seen this or maybe some of your listeners have, but there was a pretty funny / depressing article in The Onion, which is a satire newspaper,
mm-hmm,
about gun violence in America. And the headline was something like, you know, "We just can't do anything about it, says country with complete ability to do something about
right.
it." With the worst problem with this, you know, and I really don't understand the fear that our nation's politicians have of the gun lobby. I mean, to your caller's point, it's not necessarily, I don't understand how people believe it's infringing on their Second Amendment rights if they can't have like a tank parked out in front of their house and a bazooka ready to blow up, you know, a neighborhood. Where's the line? I mean, it's one thing to have a shotgun or, you know, smaller guns like a handgun or something. Not a handgun, but, you know, less fatal type guns versus military style assault weapons. It's just not the same degree of weaponry. And I don't understand why it's still such a toxic issue for people in Congress
mm-hmm.
to deal with.
Stella sends an email, Jennifer, reminding listeners of our show with Dr. Whitemute, who was on last week, actually, one of the few doctors. He's an emergency room physician, and there are only like six in the country who are studying, which is not a controversial issue, guns as a public health issue, because there's no more funding to study this. So he's put $1 million over that of his own money, left to him by his dad, to carry on with his research. At any rate, she reminds us of that interview and said, "We must continue to pressure legislators for reasonable control. We don't need automatic weapons to defend a home invader or to go hunting. Stopping and reloading is what gave the bystander in Seattle time to stop the shooter from taking more lives. Thank goodness it wasn't a semi-automatic gun."
Yeah, and I don't know if you remember this, but the Surgeon General he came up for confirmation in Congress, and one thing that he talked about in the past was gun violence as a public health issue.
Mm-hmm.
And you would not believe the outcry that he got for saying that, because it's as if you can't associate. I mean, what else do you call it when you have so like tens of thousands of people being gunned down in daily life in this country, and how can you not call it a public health issue? I don't understand why that was such a threatening thing for people to hear from the country's Surgeon General.
Gunned down.
Let's go to John. John, are you there? John.
American, shut up.
John?
How can you not call?
I'm sorry, John. You're not. I don't know what you're doing, but we can't hear you. Let's go to Carl in Michigan. Hi, Carl. Carl?
Yes.
Go ahead, Carl.
I have a daughter who works at the VA, and she says the biggest problem is they are overwhelmed and understaffed. She said the Iraq and the Afghanistan war has brought hundreds and hundreds of new patients into the VA. Plus, she said people don't realize that the Vietnam veterans now are aging, and they are requiring more medical care and medical help. The politicians should look at themselves in the mirror. They're good at criticizing everybody, but what do they do?
Thank you, Carl. Carl's got a good point, and you've made the point, too. Everybody makes the point. We're asking these people to give up their lives, you know, and then we can't treat them? We don't have facilities to treat them when they get home? Something's wrong.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, a couple of weeks ago, somebody asked on one of the Sunday political talk shows, on CNN, they had the chairman of the House Veterans Affairs Committee, and point blank, the show host went right in for that same exact point. She said, "Where have you been? Where has your committee been? You've had dozens of hearings on this." And the response you've gotten, and I think this is an underwritten story myself. I think there should be more looking at what has Congress been doing here.
Yeah, I think you're right.
But the response he said was, look, we've had lots of hearings on this stuff. We're probably culpable in this, too.
Thank you, Carl, for your call. A couple emails that have come in. Todd in Oconomowoc says, if you think the marriage decision is about minority, same-gender civil unions, you would be sorely mistaken. This is our liberal government's personal attack on a religiously defined institution. Why do you redefine what marriage is? Marriage has never been defined anywhere as same-gendered people. This is religious persecution by our government. Todd writes, John, on the other hand, writes that a study published in the March issue of Milwaukee Magazine reveals that Wisconsin is losing out on up to $43 million in LGBT wedding-related spending, much of which has been going to neighboring marriage equality states of Minnesota, Iowa, and Illinois. I wonder,
hello?
Yes, hello? Are you there, Jennifer? Hello? Yeah, can you hear me? She can.
Hello?
Yeah, I don't know why you can't hear me. Jennifer?
I can hear you now.
Oh, you can.
Hello?
Oh, well, that was weird. Okay, yes, here.
I got shuffled into your callers, I think.
Oh, so you were talking to the caller by yourself? Did you hear?
I believe I was.
Okay, okay. Oh, did you hear the messages about marriage equality that I read? Todd and John, maybe you didn't.
No, but I heard a very nice gentleman being queued up for a question.
Okay. Well, at any rate, there are still some people, and I have to believe that sentiment is changing, and it's changing pretty rapidly. There are still some people, and many of them in certain faiths, who believe that this decision is not good, that and this, Todd said, it's religious persecution by our government. Yeah, I can't help but believe that it's going to be really different even a year from now, that it's just going to be very accepted. And that's a big thing. It's a big thing in my lifetime. Isn't it?
It's huge. And, you know, you had a caller before who I didn't get to say much in response to his point about gay marriage. He was saying how, you know, there's not really people marching around, you know, gay pride celebrations where he lives, and the only marching he saw was people going to the ballots when they previously, I think he was saying, voted against having same-sex marriage. But I did want to say to that point that, you know, a lot has happened, even in the last year, on this issue. I mean, the president himself, only in the last year, has said, I think I'm in a place where I support this. It's equality for everybody. And, and you know, being a gay couple who wants to get married is not about marching up and down the streets. I mean, let's not forget what this is really about, which is about a loving couple, adults, consenting adults who love each other.
Who want to get married. Yeah.
And they want the more than 1,000, literally more than 1,000 federal benefits to being married. They want to know that they can visit each other in the hospitals when they're sick.
Jennifer, we're out of time. I thank you so much for being with us. Thanks.
Of course. Anytime.
Yeah, great. Jennifer Bendry, White House and congressional reporter for The Huffington Post, our guest for All Things Political. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour. Thanks to KP as well for on-air production. Thanks for all of your calls and comments. will return.